Coming up on today's show, yet another big day in the news. The UN General Assembly continues in New York. Vladimir Putin delivering a speech today, mobilizing up to 300,000 new troops in the conflict with Ukraine. Marcus Kolga gives the details on what that may mean. And we'll also talk about airline restrictions. Apparently, they're due to be removed in our country.
Our world is in peril and paralyzed. Geopolitical divides are undermining the work of the Security Council, undermining international law, undermining trust and people's faith in democratic institutions, undermining all forms of international cooperation. We cannot go on like this.
Secretary General Antonio Guterres of the United Nations, in his opening address yesterday, of course, it's the massive UN gathering that's taking place this week in New York City, and painting a pretty dire picture, running through a long list of things that he sees as major crises around the globe, and then saying, yeah, and we're not in a position as an international community to really address any of them, because of some of the issues we're facing as well. Much more happening today. Zelensky of Ukraine is scheduled to address the United Nations remotely. Joe Biden speaking this morning. So there's a lot happening at the United Nations. So we're going to walk through that and get an update on what might be discussed and if there'll be any sort of progress made. And to do that, we're joined by Reza Hazmath, who is a professor in political science at the University of Alberta. Professor, thank you for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Good morning.
Obviously, that opening statement from Antonio Guterres, typically it's sort of, this is the challenges that we're facing. That's how the assembly usually starts. But yesterday it seemed pretty dire and pretty urgent from Guterres.
So, yes, his main message was we need to overcome divisions, that the world is divided, that, there are major issues that we need to tackle. And we're not equipped to do so, at least in his worldview, because of these divisions.
Yeah, and he's talking about, all kinds of different things. And let's just touch on a couple of them. War, obviously, and that's the focus for a lot of the leaders speaking today. The situation in Ukraine on the minds of, well, almost everybody in attendance, correct?
Oh, definitely. In fact, most of the speeches have actually touched on Ukraine and Russia and Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
And in terms of, there's no UN resolution. NATO is basically the one side of this conversation. But what kind of things are being said at the UN and what might they be trying to do throughout the assembly this week?
So they're a bit hampered in terms of what they can actually do because Russia is a permanent member and they will veto anything in the Security Council. But for the General Assembly, it's more of a signaling what states actually think, what the world of affairs are and what Russia's aggression towards Ukraine is. And the majority of states have actually condemned the aggression. They're a bit alarmed. In fact, President Biden is speaking right now and he's talking about this idea that, we have to be alarmed by Russia's invasion, but even more so, their new movement towards having a referendum for these breakaway, or rather these disputed territories. And that would mean Russia can actually defend it on those territories with nuclear weapons if need be. And that's very alarming, of course.
Yeah, and Russia, we should say, not in attendance. They're not at the UN General, or Putin at least isn't at the General Assembly. There was some speculation that Biden might move to have Russia kicked out of the UN. We don't expect that to happen, right?
No, not realistically. And in fact, history has told us that's the worst guy to actually kick out a permanent member, a major member of the international community. We do want as many member states, if not all member states, be part of this institution and global institutions in particular, because that opens that avenue for conversation, that opens that avenue for negotiations. So that would be a really terrible move if they were to propose that.
One of the other things that a lot of the leaders are talking about, and I find very interesting, is the war on democracy and disinformation. And as you say, Guterres talked about that, the division that's taking place. And but a lot of people talking about the very institutions of democracy around the world are under attack right now.
So we are seeing a rise of extremism across the world, not only in the traditional areas, but we're seeing this in Eastern Europe. We're seeing this in parts of the U.S., parts of Canada even. So there is growing sort of extremism. And that's, tied to many of the other themes we're talking at the UN, hunger, climate change. Yeah. Look, we just came out of we're still at the tail end of a major pandemic and economies are shattered all over the world, relatively speaking. So, You know, that's what, you know, when Secretary General Guterres is talking about overcoming divisions, it's really within this sort of major context that, look, you know, we are in a fragile place as a society, as a global society right now, and we need to be very careful to, you know, come together and actually try and overcome these major challenges, because we're not actually meeting the objectives in these sustainable development goals, for example. We're not meeting them. We're not meeting the objectives for so many of the major milestones we set for ourselves.
And you know what? And you're absolutely right. We set these goals, we don't reach them, and then now we've got these new emerging crises that Guterres was talking about. Climate change—that's not a new one. But the global energy crisis that's now looming, and the food security crisis that's looming, and those are really pressing issues. Not the kind of thing you can push down the road or miss targets on.
Oh, for definitely. These are things that, you know, nations need to come together to actually try and tackle as a community. And it's interesting because, you know, in the last two decades, we've been talking about what role should the UN have? Is it needed even? And we always have these conversations around this time when the General Assembly meets. And, you know, at the end of the day, look, the United Nations General Assembly does not have the same power it once did. It's not it can't dictate the society to do X, Y, and Z. But it's still a great signal. It's still a great place for nations to come together and think, at least have big thoughts about how to overcome world challenges. And there's a utility in that.
But like you say, practically, don't expect any solutions to be offered at the end of the week, right? I mean, that's not the way it works.
That's not the way it works. These are major issues that takes a long time. Just having a buy-in by states to actually have these conversations, go through multilateralism, go through bilateralism, go through the various institutions that exist globally. I mean, this is just a stopgap for a long-term sort of problem solving.
Great discussion. Risa, thank you so much for your time this morning. I really appreciate you joining us. A few hours ago in Russia, Vladimir Putin delivered a 7-minute televised address to his nation, and a lot happened in that address. He talked about mobilizing as many as 300,000 reservists could be brought into the war. He talked about nuclear threats, said it's not a bluff, all kinds of things. So to go through the latest developments, a big day with the whole Russia-Ukraine situation, we're going to chat now with Marcus Volga, founder of disinfowatch.org and a senior fellow at the McDonald Laurier Institute Center for Advancing Canada's Interests Abroad. Marcus, thank you for joining us once again. Appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me on, Shay.
So I guess the big headline here, the number one takeaway, mobilizing possibly hundreds of thousands of reservists. What does that tell us about how Putin is viewing the progress of the situation right now?
Well, Shay, look, we're in the seventh month of what Vladimir Putin initially called a 3-day operation to denazify Ukraine. Things have not been going well. They've been on a downward slide over the past several months. And in the last 2 weeks, we've seen massive gains by the Ukrainian army in the east of Ukraine and now in the south of Ukraine. And I think that, you know, this mobilization, the statement that there are going to be 4 areas of eastern Ukraine where Russia has illegally occupied territory, they're going to be holding sham referendums to call on Russia to accept them as part of Russia. All of this, what it tells me is that Vladimir Putin is desperate. He is in a panic. The situation domestically in Russia is rapidly deteriorating. Support for his war is fading. With this conscription, call for conscription and the mobilization of these 300,000 men, and this may only be the beginning,
right?
There is a mass flight of Russian men leaving Russia. Apparently, all the flights out of Russia for the next 2 weeks are completely booked up. So things are not going well. Things are deteriorating domestically. Like I said, Vladimir Putin is right now in a serious panic.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, the cost of flights has soared to about $10,000 US to get out of the country, and they're sold out. It just mass panic to get out. Okay, so let's walk through a couple of things. First of all, it's not like he's just reaching down and getting 300,000 fully trained, ready to go, and equipped soldiers. He's talking about getting guys out of prison, expanding the age up to 60. Like, it's not like this is an immediate reactionary force even, right?
No, you're absolutely right, and thanks for bringing up that initial one of those points that he's trying to enlist conscripts. There's the man that they call Putin's chef, Yevgeny Prigozhin, who runs a private military contract group called Wagner, which has been involved in all sorts of atrocities in Africa over the past few years. There was a video that emerged just 3 or 4 days ago where he went into one of Russia's most notorious prisons filled with murderers and rapists and such, and suggested to all of these prisoners, these convicts, that if they served on the front, that they would eventually be released. And so far, he's been able to enlist 3,000 convicts. One of them, according to a report 2 days ago, is a cannibal. He was imprisoned for eating people, killing people and then eating them. These are the types of people that Vladimir Putin is trying to enlist into his failing effort right now. And further to your point about the conscripts, the 300,000 that he's looking at, these are not battle-hardened troops. These are people that may have been gone through training, 10 right. years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, even, like you said, 60-year-old men. It's not necessarily going to help them in the front. And this is not instantaneous either. It's not like these men will suddenly appear tomorrow. It's going to take a lot of time to get them trained up, to get them equipped to go to the front. And even then, there's no I don't think there's any indication that it'll help. Right now, what we've been seeing over the past couple of weeks is Russian troops deserting their positions, just jumping out of their tanks and fleeing, running literally back to Russia. And there's no reason to believe that the morale will be any different with these conscripts. So I'm not sure that it's going to make too much of a difference on the ground with these conscripts if they ever do arrive to the front. And the other thing to keep in mind is that a lot of the equipment that Vladimir Putin has been breaking down. The sanctions that we've imposed on him have inhibited his ability to actually, they've terminated his ability to fix any of those weapons. So he's using basically Soviet-era museum pieces on the front lines right now, and they're no match for the Ukrainian army and certainly the Western weapons that we've supplied them. So, the situation, even with these conscripts, doesn't mean I don't think it'll change the situation too much tactically or strategically on the ground. And I think that Ukraine will continue having this success, even though the conscripts are going to be arriving in the coming months.
Marcus, as you said, we're 7 months into this now, and it hasn't been going well for some time. Is the hesitation or the fact that it's taken this long for Putin to try and pull some lever that he may have access to because it's wildly unpopular within Russia, and this kind of comes across as an admission that things are not going well and any support that he might have within the country will be further eroded and put him in more peril?
Well, yeah, that's a great point, Shay, that, the war hasn't been entirely popular, but there hasn't been that much criticism of it either, or there hasn't been much broad criticism of it. There were initial protests in the first few weeks, but they were violently repressed. There were some 15,000 protesters who were detained and put into prison. They're facing charges, and many of them up to 10 years in prison. And so that was quite effective in silencing any criticism. But, of course, over the past week or two, we've seen that criticism rise. We've seen municipal councillors in Moscow and St. Petersburg, at least 50 of them, they've put together a public petition calling on Vladimir Putin to resign. There are various different oligarchs who have spoken out about the war. But most importantly, Russia's most popular pop singer, Alla Pugacheva, who was seen as a very close ally of Vladimir Putin's over the years, often seen partying and dining together, she came out 2 days ago and criticized this war. So if that's the case, there are definite cracks appearing. I think that's one reason why we're seeing this this panic sort of conscription, these threats of nuclear war, is that the situation domestically is deteriorating for Vladimir Putin, and he needs to respond somehow. Because ultimately, the end of Vladimir Putin will not come in any other way other than a sort of a grassroots uprising by the people of Russia. And, I think that, as someone who's been watching Vladimir Putin for the past 20 years, I see the seeds of that being planted right now. And I would argue that this could be what we're seeing right now could be the beginning of the end of Vladimir Putin.
Wow. Now, the other question that comes up every time we talk about this, that desperation that you're talking about, when he is pushed into that corner, when he is that desperate, the end of Vladimir Putin, he was talking about nuclear weapons again today and saying it is not a bluff. Is it a bluff? How real is that risk, Marcus?
Well, look, I think that we have to assume, this guy is desperate. He is a rat that is in the, that is being forced into a corner right now. He's actually, we haven't forced him into a corner. He's forced himself into that corner due to his own incompetence and the people around him. You know, I think we should expect him to lash out. He has biological weapons, chemical weapons. He has nuclear weapons. He has not hesitated over the past 7 months to target tens of thousands of civilians who have been killed, hospitals, schools, in Ukraine. So, you know, this is, we're dealing with someone who not only, I don't think he has a moral conscience, I think he's a little bit, you know, a bit of a psychopath as well. So I don't, I would expect him to use some sort of tactics or some sort of weapons of mass destruction to further terrorize Ukraine. But I would be extremely surprised if he used any sort of nuclear weapons, especially the kind of nuclear weapons that might threaten European nations or Canada or the United States. Because the one thing that the single goal that Vladimir Putin has is survival. And, you know, if he were to engage in a broader sort of nuclear conflict, that would mean the end of Vladimir Putin. He knows that. So if, when he's talking about nuclear weapons, he may be threatening the use of tactical nuclear weapons. These are nuclear weapons with very, you know, limited destructive yield that can be used on, you know, parts of a city on the battlefield and such.
Right.
He may do that. But I don't think that there's any threat of a broader nuclear conflict, although he would like to make us believe that he is actually threatening that.
That strategic tactical nuke that you're talking about, would that demand a response from the West, though? Biden has told him, do not do that. Does that red line stand if it's, like you say, something strategic, tactical, and not widespread?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. I think the West would have to respond in some way. Now, whether that's, you know, I don't think that it's a nuclear response necessarily. But we need to, I think that it would require us to increase the kinds of weapons that we're sending to the Ukrainians. You know, that should include perhaps long range artillery, the kind of artillery that might strike into places like Crimea and other parts of Ukraine that are occupied by Russia. So, yeah, I mean, it would require a response. I just don't think that the West would necessarily respond. Escalate it with nuclear weapons.
Gotcha. Marcus, incredible insight, as always. Thank you so much for joining us. Actually, we brought it up yesterday because there was all kinds of reporting yesterday. I don't want to say confirm because at this point it's still sources and there's nothing official from the federal government. But by all accounts and everything we can see, it looks like the restrictions that continue to be in place for air travelers in Canada should be gone within a little more than a week. We're going to chat now with John Gradick, who is with McGill's Aviation Management Program. John, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
No problem. It's my pleasure to be here.
So it sounds to everybody that's paying attention here that the vaccine mandate for foreign travelers, arrive can, and the random testing are going to go. Is that what you're hearing too?
I'm hearing it. There's nothing confirmed
right. Just
yet. I think we're still talking to the officials in Ottawa to try to get consensus on the date they want to do it. And it's got to be coordinated with our U.S. friends as well, because, you know, they have their vaccination mandate that's required for non-nationals. So I think there's a bit of coordination that has to happen across the borders as well as domestically. So some work to do yet.
Is everybody on board? Like, I mean, I know even NDP MPs were coming out yesterday saying, yeah, this is a good idea. We support this. I haven't seen anybody saying, no, don't do this. It seems like everybody's on board, right?
Yeah, I think everybody's kind of saying, okay, enough is enough. I think we've run the course of all of these mandates, and I think right now the issue is, you know, how do we progressively peel back the bureaucracy that we had instituted over the last couple of years and managing the mandates and managing the spread of COVID-19. So it is a question right now of unraveling the puzzle and making sure we don't, you know, drop the ball on too many things as we unravel it.
Right, yeah. In terms of the impact that still having it in place has had, you know, I mean, we had a spokesman, I think it was the Edmonton International yesterday, saying, yeah, you know, if we do this, it'll just bring us in line with more than 50 other countries and most of our international partners that long ago removed these restrictions. So how much of a burden has it been on Canada's aviation industry to have these rules hanging around?
Well, I think, you know, the biggest rule change that we're going to see happening is probably on the arrivals side for international passengers, and that's been the thorn in everybody's side, in as much as, you know, you arrive into London or you arrive into the EU or you arrive into any most other countries, there really isn't much of a debate about your health status, your quarantine status, or your vaccination status. So, you know, those types of questions and that type of submission of documentation is not required in most of the world. And, you know, I think Canada is really coming a little late to the party to join that same removal of requirements. So I think that that's going to be the biggest impact on international arrivals. There's not going to be much change domestically. We're still going to be seeing masks, and that probably will stick around for a couple of months yet. Until such time as the government feels comfortable that, you know, we've got the variants under control. But I think that, you know, the ArriveCan app will still stick around. It will stick around. It probably won't be used for vaccination statuses or testing statuses. It'll be used basically as a means of validating that you are properly documented for entry into Canada. And that's going to be a new variation on what the ArriveCan app is going to look for. And there's going to be an education process required on that one as well. So we're not out of the woods yet on the right hand.
Right, yeah. That's what we're hearing. Optional and sort of like a customs declaration way of doing that, if you so choose. I know a lot of people, I've spoken to a lot of people who are really gun-shy about traveling internationally because of what we've seen at airports, and I know there's a lot of people that say, it's because of this, it's because of the testing, it's because of ArriveCan. How true is that, and how much of a difference might this make to the operation of airlines in Canada? Obviously, it's a little more streamlined, but will it make a huge difference?
No, it's not going to make that much of a difference. I think that, you know, if you look at, you know, for those people, for those of us that have used the ArriveCan on international arrivals, we used to have to fill in that declaration form. We had to write in a whole bunch of information. And, you know, Canada's basically moved into the 21st century with the ArriveCan app gathering the same type of information. So it's nothing, and it's not different. It's probably easier, and it's, you know, you basically don't have to. The customs officer doesn't have to read through your declaration anymore. You just flash the ArriveCan app. It flashes green. You're go. So it's a very different process. It's going to take a while for everybody to get used to it. But once you've done it a few times, you're in pretty good shape. And I think that's what's going to happen, is that there's going to have to be a re-education process and a reintroduction of what the ArriveCan app should look like. But that's going to cause some grief in a very short term. But after a while, after 2 or 3 months, it should settle down.
Yeah, excellent. Okay. John, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time today. Thanks for listening today. To hear any of our other interviews, you can find them wherever you find your favorite podcasts. And if you like what you hear, don't forget to rate and review us.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his 6-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his 2-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.